The US and the EU imposed new sanctions on Russia, covering the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline amid heightened tensions with Moscow over Ukraine. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says Israel is on the decline and on the path to demise, and the regime's demise is only a matter of time. The US imposes sanctions on a number of entities and individuals, accusing them of financing Yemen's Ansarullah movement. That's also ahead. World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. And our top story, the United States and the European Union imposed new sanctions on Russia amid tensions with Moscow over Ukraine. The U.S. Treasury announced sanctions on the company in charge of building Russia's Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. Berlin has already suspended its certification of the pipeline, which is to funnel Russian natural gas to Germany under the Baltic Sea. The European Union also targeted Russia's defense minister and military chiefs. The 27-nation bloc slapped asset freezes and visa bans on high-ranking officials, including the commanders of Russia's army, navy, and air force. The Kremlin's chief of staff and the head of the RT TV channel. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin says Moscow is open to diplomacy to resolve the standoff over Ukraine.
Our country is always open for direct and honest dialogue, for the search for diplomatic solutions to the most complex problems. The interests of Russia, the security of our citizens are non-negotiable for us.
In a video address on the occasion of a public holiday, Putin said Russia's military will stand up for the country's national interests. Moscow has recognized the two self-proclaimed republics of Luhansk and Donetsk in eastern Ukraine and ratified friendship treaties with them. It also plans to deploy Russian peacekeepers to the breakaway regions. Western states, including the U.S., continue to claim that Russia is preparing a full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree recognizing breakaway Luhansk and Donetsk regions in eastern Ukraine as independent republics. Putin made the announcement live on television after an emotional address. He referred to eastern Ukraine as ancient Russian lands and said it was managed by foreign powers. Putin also told Russia's defense ministry to deploy troops into the two regions. The decree was issued shortly after he announced his recognition of the region's independence from Ukraine. Putin also accused Ukraine of extreme nationalism and Russophobia. He said Kyiv was sending saboteurs to target Russian infrastructure. He denounced Ukraine's ambition to join NATO as an immediate threat of attack against his country. Putin said that the decision was in response to years of conflict in war-torn eastern Ukraine and accused Kyiv of not being interested in peaceful solutions. Russia's top diplomat Sergei Lavrov has said Moscow will act as a guarantor of the security and integrity of the two breakaway Donbas republics in Donetsk and Luhansk.
Well, I think it sends the message that that Russia is extremely concerned by the fact that the United States has not given any indication of recognizing some of their demands for security for Russia as well as security for the West. They're moving ahead with military operations and military equipment in Ukraine.
The latest crisis can be traced back to 2014. Back then, Western-backed protesters toppled Ukraine's pro-Moscow government. Tensions then flared up in eastern Ukraine. Following a brief war, Crimea came under the control of Moscow when the peninsula was reabsorbed into Russia following a referendum. Ukraine, as well as most of the world, considered the referendum illegitimate and views Crimea as illegally occupied by Moscow.
At the Munich summit, of course, President Zelensky was there saying that Ukraine wanted to be the bastion of the West against Russia, calling also on a possibility of them becoming a nuclear power. This, of course, is absolutely unacceptable for Russia, and speaking words, of course, were not sufficient, and therefore they had to take action.
So the US and Europe are coordinating a raft of sanctions against Russia over its decision on the eastern Ukrainian regions. They have targeted Russia's exports, banking and financial institutions, as well as individuals. Germany has also halted the certification process of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline project. Those measures would certainly have an impact on Russia, but Americans and Europeans too would bear the brunt of those sanctions.
Putin's decision to recognize the independence of Luhansk and Donetsk has sparked criticism. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced that Britain is imposing a series of sanctions under the governments against Russia. Five Russian banks, as well as three very high net worth individuals, have had their UK assets frozen. Dutch Prime Minister said European Union countries have agreed to impose a limited set of sanctions targeting those who are responsible for Russia's recognition of the breakaway regions. Germany has also decided to freeze the certification of Nord Stream 2 pipeline project, which is considered a blow to Russia's energy sector. U.S. President Joe Biden has said that the United States would impose financial penalties on Russia because of its deployment of troops into two breakaway regions of eastern Ukraine.
Well, the U.S. has already introduced sanctions. President Biden did that last night. I don't think sanctions by Ukraine against Russia are going to have much of an effect, but the U.S. sanctions and whatever they can pull together with the European so-called allies will have an effect. But the problem is that there's a very shaky international financial system that we have today. It is a bubble economy, and the slightest shock can pull the whole thing down.
Biden said that the U.S. would sanction Russian sovereign debt and Russian elites as well as their family members. New economic sanctions will be placed on Russia's biggest financial institutions as well. The president said he's also working with Germany to prevent the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from moving forward and is cutting off Russia's government from Western financing.
So that what the West is risking here, regardless really of what the Russians do in retaliation, and I'm sure they will react in whatever way they think possible, this whole system can come down in the world's greatest depression. So you have that, the shaky financial system, which is being shaken even more by this crisis. You have the spread of COVID, and you have the danger of war, in fact, possibility of nuclear war. If this thing goes further, it can be really the end of humanity as we know it.
Japan will likely join U.S.-led sanctions on Russia, including a ban on chip and other key technology exports, should Putin order an invasion of Ukraine. Russia has accused NATO of encroaching on its sphere of influence. It says NATO's addition of 14 new East European members since the end of Cold War is a threat to its security. It says Ukraine must not be allowed to join the military alliance. The U.S. and its allies have ruled out defending Ukraine with military force, but say they would respond to any invasion with sanctions, arms shipments, and reinforcements of NATO countries nearby.
Okay, got some breaking news reaching us here. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has announced a special military operation in eastern Ukraine. Putin is addressing the Russian people, which is coinciding with the UN Security Council meeting. The Russian president also said that clashes between Ukrainian and Russian forces are inevitable and only a question of time. He said further NATO expansion and its use of Ukraine's territory are unacceptable demands that Russia have been calling for the past months now. And he said the Russian military operation aims to protect people and the circumstances demand decisive action from Russia. Also, according to Reuters, Putin says we do not plan to occupy Ukrainian territory and says the clashes between Russia and Ukrainian forces are inevitable and just a matter of time. Let's see if we've got any more on that. Putin also says the Russian response will be instant and the responsibility of any bloodshed will be on the conscience of the Ukrainian regime. That's quoting Putin. So Putin there making us Prize speech on a special operation in eastern Ukraine, according to Putin, to save lives, to avoid bloodshed, and he's called on Ukrainian forces there to lay down their arms in that Donbass region, which is people there that are residing there have left in their droves amid the reports of shelling and who are native Russians. We'll bring you more on that breaking news story as we get it. Now, the Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah warns Israel against waging a war in Lebanon, adding that his forces are completely prepared for any attack. In an interview with Al Manar TV, Nasrallah said the Israeli regime is on the decline and on the path to demise. He said the demise of the Israeli regime is only a matter of time, suggesting that the term temporary regime to be used for Israel. Nasrallah said Hezbollah seeks justice and peace and would defend the Lebanese people and their freedom. The Palestinian envoy to the United Nations calls on the Security Council to end Israel's apartheid and protect his people from the regime's atrocities. Riyad Mansour says mere announcement of condemnation would never suffice to deter the Israeli regime. The Palestinian envoy asked the term apartheid 15 times to describe the Israeli regime. The Israeli envoy, who was present at the session, criticized the apartheid messaging after the meeting. Gilad Erdan claimed that describing Israel as an apartheid regime is a joint campaign between human rights organizations and the Palestinians to delegitimize Israel. Tel Aviv routinely attacks human rights organizations and has even barred them or barred the investigation of the regime's possible war crimes. Now, Israel has carried out yet another strike on Syria, targeting the capital, Damascus. The Syrian military says that its air defenses have intercepted a barrage of Israeli missiles over the city. According to the military, 3 Syrian soldiers have been killed as a result of the regime's latest act of aggression. Our Damascus correspondent Mohammed Ali has given us more details about the attack.
An official military source said in a statement that there has been a new Israeli attack on Syria and aggression at about 1:10 a.m. Local time over here. Israeli fighter jets carried out an attack, launching a number of missiles targeting Syrian army positions in the vicinity of the Syrian capital, Damascus. The Syrian military source said in that statement that the Syrian air defenses were able to shoot down most of the enemy missiles. However, the Israeli attack killed 3 Syrian army soldiers and also caused material damage. Now, this is the second Israeli attack in less than 24 hours. Yesterday, there was an attack on Al-Quneitra in southern Syria, and this is the 4th Israeli attack just this month. It is very important to note that this attack and the one that happened yesterday come just about 24 hours after Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal al-Maqdad actually warned Israel from pressing ahead with such attacks. And al-Maqdad said that Syria has the power and the capability to respond to the repeated Israeli attacks, whether in the framework of international legitimacy or in the framework of self-defense, and that Syria has the right whenever it wishes to respond in all forms, and that Israel should realize this fact.
In other news, the United States imposes sanctions on a number of entities and individuals, accusing them of providing tens of millions of dollars to Yemen's Ansar Allah movement. The action freezes any assets of the designated individuals that are subject to U.S. jurisdiction and bars Americans from doing business with them. Those targeted include a UAE and Sweden-based commodities trader and his company, as well as money exchange houses in Turkey and Yemen. They are accused of shipping fuel and other petroleum products and commodities throughout the Middle East, Africa, and Asia, with the proceeds financing Ansar Allah. This comes as the movement, along with the Yemeni army, has been defending the country against Saudi Arabia's years-long aggression. The war, which started in 2015, has so far killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians. The United Nations says the country is facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Turning to other news now, Iran's president says the policy of the Islamic Republic is to promote cooperation with friendly countries. Ibrahim Raisi made the remark during a meeting with Oman's foreign minister, Sayyid Badr al-Busaidi, in Tehran. Raisi stressed the need for efforts to enhance the economic and trade ties between Iran and Oman, considering their great capacities. He also hailed Muscat for adopting right and decent policies and paying attention to the issues of Palestine, Yemen, and regional security. Now, for his part, the Omani minister thanked Iran for supporting its neighbors. Al-Busaidi noted that the relations between Tehran and Muscat benefit regional and international security. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 agreement are engaged in intense talks aimed at reviving the landmark accord. Now Tehran says it will not cross its red lines during the negotiations.
We did emphasize this to the EU foreign policy chief, saying that emphasizing that we'll never cross our red lines in the Vienna talks. We will under no circumstances cross the red lines.
Emir Abdullahian said the talks have reached a sensitive level, adding that a few but very important issues have yet to be resolved. The top diplomat added that Tehran will continue the negotiations as long as they're useful and end in good results. The Iranian official noted that Tehran has received multiple requests from the U.S. side for direct talks, but he added that rhetoric alone is not enough, and Washington has so far failed to take actual steps to show its goodwill. The eighth round of negotiations are to restore the deal that is underway in Austria's capital, Vienna.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
IRIB English Radio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
In the U.S., a federal prosecutor in the hate crimes trial for the three white men who murdered Ahmed Arbery told the jury in closing arguments on Monday, 21st of February, that the defendants had targeted Mr. Arbery because of his race and did not help him after he was shot because they considered him to be subhuman. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Tariro Mezezewa and Richard Fawcett. The piece is titled Hate Crime Case in Arbery Murder Goes to Jury. In the U.S., a federal prosecutor in the hate crimes trial for the three white men who murdered Ahmed Arbery told the jury in closing arguments on Monday, 21st of February, that the defendants had targeted Mr. Arbery because of his race and did not help him after he was shot because they considered him to be subhuman. Defense attorneys argued that their clients had chased Mr. Arbery because they thought he may have committed a crime. And despite copious evidence that the men harbored bigoted beliefs, including referring to black people as animals, and that two of them repeatedly used racist slurs, defense lawyers said that there was not enough evidence to prove that racism was the reason they had pursued Ahmed Arbery, a 25-year-old black man, through their neighborhood on a Sunday afternoon in February of 2020. On Monday afternoon, 21st of February, the jury began deliberating on whether the five-minute pursuit, which ended in the fatal shooting of Mr. Arbery, amounted to a crime of interfering with his right to use public streets because of his race or color, as an indictment put it. The three defendants, Gregory McMichael, a 66-year-old, his son Travis McMichael, a 36-year-old, and their neighbor William Bryan, 52 years old, have already been found guilty of murder in state court and sentenced to life in prison, with only William Bryan given the possibility of parole. They could face additional sentences up to life imprisonment in the federal case, which includes a charge of attempted kidnapping and weapons charges for the McMichaels. The week-long federal trial revealed, often in disturbing detail, the dehumanizing ways that the men viewed African Americans, with evidence that Travis McMichael and William Bryan used racist slurs in electronic communications, and a witness who said that Gregory McMichael once stated, "All those blacks are nothing but trouble. I wish they would all die." But none of the evidence presented in court showed that these slurs and insults were aimed specifically at Ahmed Arbery. The trial will now turn on whether the jury feels that the prosecution created a sufficient link between the defendants' previous racist statements and the decisions they made on the day of the killing. It's critical that there be a nexus shown between the racial beliefs of these men and the actions that they took on that day, said Ronald Carlson, an emeritus professor of law at the University of Georgia who followed the case closely. That is to say that they were actuated in significant part, not exclusively perhaps, but in significant part, by racial animus. The trial is a high-profile test for the Justice Department. Last year, Attorney General Merrick Garland vowed to make the investigation and prosecution of hate crimes a top priority, at a time when the number of reported hate crimes are at their highest point in more than a decade. Not guilty verdicts would almost certainly raise questions about the wisdom of the government's decision to bring the case against the men and underscore the limitations of hate crime prosecutions more generally. It would also leave a bitter taste in the mouths of Mr. Arbery's family, as well as the many people around the nation repulsed by the pursuit and killing of an unarmed man that the Reverend Al Sharpton has called a lynching in the 21st century. One of the lawyers delivering the government's closing argument was Christopher Perez of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. He reminded jurors that even though the federal statute the men are charged under is commonly called a hate crimes law, it was not necessary for the government to show that the men had hate in their hearts on the day of the killing. Rather, he said, the government had to show only that race was one of the reasons it happened. Christopher Perez argued that what motivated the men that day was not, as they claimed, a concern about neighborhood crime. It was about race, he said, racial assumptions, racial resentment, and racial anger. The prosecutor said the men's actions amounted not to vigilance, but to vigilantism. When Greg McMichael saw Ahmed Arbery jogging by his house and Greg suspected that Ahmad was up to no good, he didn't call police. He grabbed his son and his gun and chased after him. When that chase passed by Mr. Bryan's house, he said William Bryan gave chase as well, automatically assuming that Ahmad Arbery must have been up to no good because he was being chased by two white men, rather than suspecting the white men might be in the wrong. Over the course of their case, prosecutors emphasized that some of the racist statements made by the men occurred just days or months before they went after Ahmad Arbery. On Monday, Christopher Perez said that the McMichaels hated black people and projected their racial hatred onto Ahmad. As proof of the projection, Mr. Perez noted that Travis McMichael had told a friend that he suspected Mr. Arbery of stealing a gun from his truck, even though there is no evidence that Ahmad Arbery had done so. At around the same time the gun went missing, Christopher Perez noted the friend sent a video to Mr. McMichael of a black man sticking a firecracker up his nose. Mr. McMichael, using a racist slur, said it would have been cooler if the man had blown his head off. Christopher Perez also paired what he called the disproportionate reaction the three men had to seeing a black man running in their neighborhood with the disproportionate reaction once Travis McMichael shot Mr. Arbery three times at close range with his 12-gauge shotgun. Video introduced at trial showed Mr. Arbery lying on the pavement with his body moving slightly as he struggled to breathe his last breaths. The men did nothing to help him. Mr. Perez said, "They did not see a fellow human being in the street, but a subhuman savage." He characterized Gregory McMichael's conversation with responding police officers as something that sounded like a man describing a hunting trip. "I ask you to hold these defendants accountable," he said. "Hold them accountable not only for what they did, but for why they did it." In her closing statement, the lawyer for Travis McMichael acknowledged that the evidence presented in court of his racism was disturbing, but the lawyer, Amy Lee Copeland, noted that racist talk was not illegal, and she said that the government had not done enough to show that the pursuit and killing was motivated by race. She said that Mr. McMichael believed Mr. Arbery was going to harm him, and that Mr. McMichael was defending himself when he fired the shots at Ahmad Arbery. J. Pete Theodosian, a lawyer for William Bryan, said that his client would have helped to pursue any person who was being chased down his street, regardless of their race. His instincts told him people do not get chased like that. People do not get chased like that unless they've done something wrong, he said. AJ Balbo, a lawyer for Greg McMichael, noted that the police had on previous occasions shown Mr. McMichael's surveillance videos of Mr. Arbery inside of a house under construction near the McMichaels' home. That meant Mr. McMichael recognized Mr. Arbery on the afternoon of 23rd of February 2020 when Mr. Arbery ran past him. When he's in the driveway and he looked up, he may not have known Mr. Arbery's name, but he knew who he was, Mr. Balbo said of Mr. McMichael. Mr. Balbo offered the jury a hypothetical. What if a black man who did not look like Mr. Arbery had run down the street that day? A 350-pound man, say, with a tall mohawk. Mr. Balbo contended that Mr. McMichael would not have chased after such a man. Mr. Balbo also noted that there was no evidence presented at trial that his client had used racial slurs, although he had made racially provocative statements. At trial, investigators noted that they were unable to fully search Mr. McMichael's encrypted cell phone for digital evidence of past behavior. Notably, jurors in the case were not made aware that William Bryan had told investigators that Travis McMichael had used a racist slur in the moments after he shot Ahmad Arbery. That crucial detail, refuted by Mr. McMichael's lawyers, was likely not introduced because William Bryan exercised his Fifth Amendment right not to take the witness stand. That, in turn, would have derived Mr. McMichael of his Sixth Amendment right to confront his accuser.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and we now present you words of wisdom from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Faith stands on four supports. They are dependence upon God, entrustment with God, submission to the decision of God, and satisfaction with the acts of God. Disbelief stands on four supports. They are the desire for worldly pleasures, fear from missing any worldly pleasure, anger, and passion.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, encouragement. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of encouragement or encouraging our kids in the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the family and the family life, and especially when we are talking about the training the kids, it is necessary to encourage them to perform good deeds, or maybe when they are performing some good actions, we must encourage them, we must applaud them, we must mark this activity which they have done in a good sense, so that they are encouraged to do more, to perform more. And this is one of the best ways of having kids following the path or the good path which they were following. So generally, we can see that unfortunately in our lives, when we see our kids doing something good, we never encourage them. We do not encourage them. We do not notice, we never notice that they have done something good. For example, when the kids are making noise and jumping here and there, we clearly notice that they're making noise. And then we ask them to stop making noise, or maybe some of us do give them some time out for some couple of hours in which we think that they are disturbing us, maybe if we are watching TV or working from home and all those things that we do. So we see them making noise, and maybe sometime we give them some time out, or maybe we get angry upon them. But whenever they are silent, we never notice it, and we never encourage them on what they're doing when they saw us being busy. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of encouragement, or encouraging the kids in the training of kids. So we said that generally we see what our kids do. If they do something wrong, we generally notice it very quickly. But whenever they are good kids, they're not disturbing you. Maybe when you're praying, they're praying next to you. So we do not encourage them for the things they do good. So this shows us that we do not have the right way of looking at our kids, and we are not attentive towards our kids. Whereas if we see that our kids, they are praying, it is better to give them some gifts or anything which they like after a week or a month. Maybe, you know, when they start reading Quran, and if they have finished, for example, one juz, so you should give them some gifts, so they are encouraged to do more. And similarly, when the daughter is, for example, when you go out, she's observing hijab, when you come back, have some gift, have some kind of encouragement for them. Maybe you just praise them. Maybe, obviously, you show more love towards your kids. The gift can be anything. It's not just the material thing. We're not talking about the gift as the gift like chocolates or maybe a toy or anything else. It can be showing more love. It can be anything through which you can see that your kids, they realize that you're encouraging them, and they are encouraged and they're willing to perform that thing even more than before. So it is very necessary to have this encouragement in the family for the husband, for the wife, for the kids, in order to have an Islamic family, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
History shows a gun barrel never stops people from acquiring their learning tools. A bookshop in the besieged Gaza Strip is a testimony, as book lovers flooded the store months after it was flattened in an Israeli airstrike. The new Samir Mansour bookshop, funded by an international donor campaign, now stands some 200 meters from its original site. It was destroyed by an Israeli airstrike on the west of Gaza City last year. The new shop is spread across two floors and is stocked with some 400,000 books. They range from school texts to the Quran to Arabic translations of European literary classics. Hundreds of people, including writers and Palestinian officials, attended the bookshop's reopening. The store first opened its doors 30 years ago and is considered the oldest and the biggest in Gaza. Hundreds of Pakistani youths have flown their kites from rooftops in the city of Rawalpindi, celebrating an ancient tradition despite a ban imposed on the festival. People buy or make their own kites to participate in the festival, marking the arrival of spring. Local fairs are also held on this day, where families meet and vendors sell food and decorative clothing. Many people wear different shades of yellow to welcome the new season. The festival can become competitive too, with kite-fighting battles. In pursuit of victory, some kite flyers started using powdered glass of metal or metal on their kite strings to cut down other kites. The event was prohibited in 2007 after a slew of fatal accidents. The 37th edition of Fajr International Music Festival has wrapped up with an awards ceremony. During the annual event, music bands from Iran and the world took to the stage to perform their tunes. Yusuf Jalali has more.
From Iran's genuine traditional music to Italian tunes and Afghanistan's Qawwali music, music bands from many parts of the world have been performing on the stage of Iran's Fajr Music Festival. The 37th edition of the week-long event now came to an end with an award ceremony in Tehran, with best music performances cheered and awarded.
In the past 2 years, when the pandemic has cancelled concerts, my team focused on producing albums. I produced 3 albums, and one of them, titled Prime Meridian, won the award tonight.
Fortunately, I won the award for Best Composer tonight. I'm so glad that I was recognized and my work has been seen and appreciated in Iran's most prestigious music festival.
Italian jazz pianist Giovanni Guidi Egyptian oud virtuoso Mohammed Abu Zikri and German pianist Moritz Ernst were among the participants who performed during the festival. As the host, Iran had a strong presence, with pop, classic and traditional music ensembles performing in the festival. Music bands say Fajr Festival is one of the most ethnically diverse music event, where musicians with different nationalities can enjoy each other's performances.
No nation is at war with any other nation. It's the politics that imposes wars and divides nations. Now, such festivals help different nations to come together and listen to each other's music. This definitely bridges the gaps caused by politics.
Fajr International Music Festival is held as part of the nationwide celebrations in Iran, marking the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. After a two-year hiatus, the 37th Fajr Music Festival was held in person, but with a limited capacity amid the spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. Fajr Music Festival offers a rare chance to listen to live music performances from different parts of the world. And this is where music transcends boundaries and interconnects nations, as it is a universal language that everyone can feel for and enjoy, no matter where they come from. I'm Yusuf Jalali in Tehran.
The City of London usually welcomes arts and culture from all over the world, including Iran. In our next report, Bianca Rahimi will be taking us to a performance that fuses music from across the East.
A dream has become a reality. The Conference of the Birds, composed by the brilliant young musician Mehsan Marvasti and inspired by a poem of the same name written by poet Attar of Nishapur in the 12th century, performed here in London. It's a story all Iranians are familiar with, about an epic journey to find the Simurgh.
The Simurgh is to the east what the phoenix is to the west, a mythical creature that symbolizes transformation. And the story of the Simurgh is a spiritual one, full of courage, determination, and self-discovery.
Well, I think it's the first time I've seen so prominently advertised a non-Western musical traditional concert. And I've got a long-standing interest in music from the different parts of the Islamic world. It kind of evokes sort of deeper feelings, spiritual feelings. And the fact that this specific concert is about kind of a spiritual poem, it taps into something which I think a lot of us are looking for, especially in this post-pandemic, current pandemic situation. We're looking for some deeper meanings. So I think it will be striking a chord for a lot of people.
It's a mix, a fusion of different music, and that's always interesting. And it's Eurasian music, and it uses different instruments from across Asia to represent birds, and it just sounded lovely.
Even though there are differences, cultural differences between these places and these peoples, and those differences should be recognised in general, that through things like music and art, there can also be synergy, and things can work together as well.
5 years in the making, the Conference of the Birds, conducted by Farnoush Behzad, brought together musicians and instruments from across the world. It fuses Azeri, Chinese, Indian, Arabic, Afghan, Armenian and Persian music, brought to the audience by a Western orchestra. The performance was accompanied by two elocutionists who narrated the story and animated clips of birds and their migratory lives. The art and culture of Iran needs no introduction, renowned worldwide. But young Iranian artists living far from home are always looking for ways to capture the spirit of their homeland and offer Western audiences a taste of Iran. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Axolotls are unique Mexican amphibians at risk of extinction, and many conservation programs are now trying to save these strange-looking animals. An ecological park in Mexico City is the latest place to celebrate them. It has held a ceremony for releasing baby axolotls into their natural habitat, which is the mud. These amphibians are so special that even a number of city officials attended the event. Conservationists say having a clean environment is key to their survival.
I've managed to breed up to 22,000 axolotls. In all of Xochimilco, there are 90 axolotls across 90 kilometers, but the quality of the axolotls depends on the quality of biologist you are. Bad quality water has killed anywhere from 12,000 to 15,000.
Researchers have discovered that axolotls can absorb oxygen from the surface of their skin and are therefore more vulnerable to dirty water and environments. More than 70 breeding centers across Mexico have joined the rally of saving these critically endangered species. Many are even marketing them as ideal pets, but to animal advocates, keeping axolotls as pets is a definite no-no.
And for those who are interested in archaeology, the remains of 14 mummies have been unearthed at an ancient site in central Peru. The mummies, believed to be over 1,000 years old, include 6 children and 8 adults. The tomb containing the bodies was found at an archaeological complex about 25 kilometers from the capital, Lima. Researchers discovered other objects such as clay pots, decorated calabashes, and some knitting gears near the mummies. They believe the children and adults were sacrificed in honor of a prominent local figure whose mummified body was found last November in the same area. Van Dalen says the discovery provides them with the oldest evidence of child sacrifice associated with the burial of an elite character in the pre-Inca era. The city of Cajamarquia, which was built out of mud in around 200 BC, is considered as one of the largest archaeological complexes in Peru.
A miniature bull in Germany's Bavaria is proving that size does not matter, as the small bovine makes himself comfortable in his new herd at an animal sanctuary. This tiny bull had a lucky escape and was rescued from a farmer who was taking him to a slaughterhouse. The mini cow is named Napoleon and was born with a genetic defect. Just 8 months old, the diminutive bull has already reached his full size. Napoleon might be small, but he is mighty and daring, as he is not afraid of joining a herd consisting of big and huge animals.
Napoleon belongs to the Dexter breed, which produces rather small cattle anyway. They grow up to be about 1.2 meters. With his 80 centimeters, he is of course far below that. Despite his size, he feels like a complete bull and is in a good mood. He has settled in with us very quickly, which we are very happy about. He also has a lively effect on the herd.
The little bovine now lives with 100 other rescued livestock. His rescuers say he gets along with other animals and has already become friendly with another rescued cow. The Dexter is a breed of cattle first originated in Ireland. They are usually bred for high-quality meat and milk. An Indonesian man frees a crocodile of a tire that was stuck around its neck some 6 years ago. Tilly, a self-taught rescuer and resident of Central Sulawesi province, captured the reptile and cut the tie using a small saw with the help of some locals. The animal had been too smart to be trapped. Tilly says he had been tracking the reptile for weeks using a basic prop with a rope tied to a log. He used live chickens and dogs as bait to lure the reptile. The crocodile drew the sympathy of local residents who worried the tire would choke as it grows in size. Tilly says his main motive was to help animals, claiming it was not his first experience dealing with a crocodile.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
While many assume that they will be immune after catching COVID, experts say the emergence of Omicron variant has seen a significant increase in reinfection. We now present you an article written by Caitlin Cassidy. The piece is titled, What the Hell? The Unlucky Australians Who Have Caught COVID Twice. Peter Coleman took a rapid antigen test just weeks after recovering from COVID-19. It was partially for the fun of it. Peter first tested positive for the virus on 10th of January, during the post-holiday period that saw a spike in cases hit Melbourne, Australia, and elsewhere. He says, I was feeling really unwell, but I didn't expect to be positive. I thought I'd just double-check. He adds, I was on the phone with my friend after I took the test, and then I looked over and I was just like, I have to go, like, what the hell? Peter is one of the unlucky Australians to have been reinfected with COVID-19 after making a full or partial recovery from the virus. No data on COVID-19 reinfections is currently being collated by the federal government, but a spokesperson for the Department of Health says, the emergence of the Omicron variant has seen a significant increase in the risk of reinfection compared with previous variants. The spokesperson says, there is increasing evidence that there is little cross-neutralization with Omicron variant. Whether Omicron infection protects against another Omicron infection is unclear, and there remains significant uncertainty about the durability of immunity following infection with the emergence of Omicron. When Peter first acquired the virus, he was hit by brain fog so bad he forgot how to order food on Uber Eats, along with muscle aches and fatigue. The second time, though, symptoms were very different, more akin to a common cold or flu. Peter, who works from home, says he had no idea where he acquired the second infection, only that it happened just outside the 30-day period when he initially tested positive. Fully vaccinated, Peter expects he had been hit by the Omicron strain, but has no way to know for sure. Peter says the second bout was relatively minor. When a nurse rang to check on him, she asked if he was feeling depressed. I said, not depressed, but unimpressed. The Communicable Disease Network Australia continues to monitor the evidence on reinfection and whether the definition of reinfection in the National Public Health Guidelines requires review. If someone is re-exposed to the virus in the 28th day after being released from isolation, they're exempt from further quarantine, a decision last reviewed on 2nd of February. A senior research fellow at the Kirby Institute's Infection Analytics Program, Dr. Deborah Cromer, says the likelihood of acquiring a COVID-19 infection twice is partially dependent on the variant and the time since.